means they might not be on track to be in the highest level of math in high school, which means they won't get into Stanford. So it isn't surprising that so many parents are hovering and over-supervising, not just to ensure safety, but to ensure that children do homework and prepare for tests. Some of these parents may think that making sure their children do whatever it takes to succeed in advanced courses helps their children develop grit. But, as psychology professor Angela Duckworth, author of the book Grit, told us, grit is often misunderstood as perseverance without passion, and that's tragic. Perseverance without passion is mere drudgery. Duckworth wants young people to devote themselves to pursuits that are intrinsically fulfilling. The college admissions process nowadays makes it harder for high school students to enjoy school and pursue intrinsic fulfillment. The process warps the values of students drawn into a competitive frenzy and jeopardizes their mental health, says Frank Bruni, a New York Times columnist and author of Where You Go Is Not Who You Will Be, An Antidote to the College Admissions Mania. Nowhere is that more apparent than in suicide clusters at highly competitive high schools, such as those in Palo Alto, California, and the suburbs of Boston, which have been profiled in The Atlantic and The New York Times. In a 2015 survey, 95% of students at Lexington High School in Massachusetts reported a lot of stress or extreme stress about their classes. And in a 2016 study, the Centers for Disease Control reported that the teen suicide rate in Palo Alto, California, was more than 4 times the national average. And it is precisely these elite, wealthy, and hyper-competitive school districts that provide the largest share of students at the top universities in the United States. Students are prepared academically, but they're not prepared to deal with day-to-day life, says Gray, which comes from a lack of opportunity to deal with ordinary problems. One paradox of upper-middle-class American life is that some of the things parents and schools do to help kids get admitted to college may make them less able to thrive once they're there. Childhood as democracy prep. The effects of play deprivation and over-supervision may extend far beyond college. Stephen Horowitz, an economist at Ball State University in Indiana, took the same research on play that we have reviewed in this chapter and worked out some possible consequences for the future of liberal democracies. He drew on the work of political scientists Eleanor Ostrom and Vincent Ostrom, both of whom studied how self-governing communities resolve conflicts peacefully. Successful democracies do this by developing a variety of institutions and norms that enable people with different goals and conflicting desires to resolve their problems while rarely appealing to the police or the state to coerce their fellow citizens. This is the art of association that so impressed Alexis de Tocqueville when he traveled through the United States in 1835. Citizens of a democracy don't suddenly develop this art on their 18th birthday. It takes many years to cultivate these skills, which overlap with the ones that Peter Gray maintains are learned during free play. Of greatest importance in free play is that it is always voluntary. Anyone can quit at any time and disrupt the activity, so children must pay close attention to the needs and concerns of others if they want to keep the game going. They must work out conflicts over fairness on their own. No adult can be called upon to side with one child against another. Horowitz points out that when adult-supervised activities crowd out free play, children are less likely to develop the art of association. As he puts it, quote, denying children the freedom to explore on their own takes away important learning opportunities that help them to develop not just independence and responsibility, but a whole variety of social skills that are central to living with others in a free society. If this argument is correct, parenting strategies and laws that make it harder for kids to play on their own pose a serious threat to liberal societies by flipping our default settings from figure out how to solve this conflict on your own to invoke force and or third parties whenever conflict arises. This is one of the vulnerabilities of democracies noted by Vincent Ostrom. End quote. The consequences for democracies could be dire, particularly for a democracy such as the United States, which is already suffering from ever-rising cross-party hostility and declining trust in institutions. Here is what Horowitz fears could be in store. Quote, "A society that weakens children's ability to learn these skills denies them what they need to smooth social interaction. The coarsening of social interaction that will result will create a world of more conflict and violence, and one in which people's first instinct will be increasingly to evoke coercion by other parties to solve problems they ought to be able to solve themselves." End quote. This is what Greg began to see around 2013. Increasing calls from students for administrators and professors to regulate who can say what, who gets to speak on campus, and how students should interact with one another, even in private settings. The calls for more regulation and the bureaucratic impulse to provide that regulation are the subject of our next chapter. We end this chapter, however, on a more positive note. In contrast to all the unwisdom kids are exposed to in the form of the three great untruths, here is a better way to frame the experiences of childhood and adolescence. In June 2017, John Roberts, the Chief Justice of the United States, was invited to be the commencement speaker at his son's graduation from middle school. Like Van Jones, whom we quoted in Chapter 4, Roberts understands anti-fragility. He wishes for his son's classmates to have the sorts of painful experiences that will make them better people and better citizens. Here is an excerpt from his speech. "From time to time in the years to come, I hope you will be treated unfairly, so that you will come to know the value of justice. I hope that you will suffer betrayal, because that will teach you the importance of loyalty. Sorry to say, but I hope you will be lonely from time to time, so that you don't take friends for granted. I wish you bad luck again from time to time, so that you will be conscious of the role of chance in life and understand that your success is not completely deserved and that the failure of others is not completely deserved either. And when you lose, as you will from time to time, I hope, every now and then, your opponent will gloat over your failure. It is a way for you to understand the importance of sportsmanship. I hope you'll be ignored, so you know the importance of listening to others. And I hope you will have just enough pain to learn compassion. Whether I wish these things or not, they're going to happen. And whether you benefit from them or not will depend upon your ability to see the message in your misfortunes." In sum, 1. The decline of unsupervised free play is our fourth explanatory thread. Children, like other mammals, need free play in order to finish the intricate wiring process of neural development. Children deprived of free play are likely to be less competent, physically and socially, as adults. They are likely to be less tolerant of risk and more prone to anxiety disorders. 2. Free play, according to Peter Gray, is activity that is freely chosen and directed by the participants and undertaken for its own sake, not consciously pursued to achieve ends that are distinct from the activity itself. This is the kind of play that play experts say is most valuable for children. Yet, it is also the kind of play that has declined most sharply in the lives of American children. 3. The decline in free play was likely driven by several factors, including an unrealistic fear of strangers and kidnapping since the 1980s, the rising competitiveness for admission to top universities over many decades, a rising emphasis on testing, test preparation, and homework, and a corresponding de-emphasis on physical and social skills since the early 2000s. 4. The rising availability of smartphones and social media interacted with these other trends, and the combination has greatly changed the way American children spend their time and the kinds of physical and social experiences that guide the intricate wiring process of neural development. 5. Free play helps children develop the skills of cooperation and dispute resolution that are closely related to the art of association upon which democracies depend. When citizens are not skilled in this art, they are less able to work out the ordinary conflicts of daily life. They will more frequently call for authorities to apply coercive force to their opponents. They will be more likely to welcome the bureaucracy of safetyism. Chapter 10. The Bureaucracy of Safetyism. A quotation from Alexis de Tocqueville, Democracy in America. The sovereign power, or soft despot, extends its arms over the entire society. It covers the surface of society with a network of small, complicated, minute, and uniform rules. It does not tyrannize, it hinders, it represses, it enervates, it extinguishes, it stupefies, and finally, it reduces each nation to being nothing more than a flock of timid and industrious animals, of which the government is the shepherd. Remember the thought experiment in Chapter 2, in which you visited your campus counseling center and the psychologist there made you more anxious rather than less? Now, imagine it's a few days after your visit, and you receive an email from the Associate Dean of Students with Conduct Policy Reminder in the subject line. You open it nervously, wondering why the Associate Dean would be reminding you about the conduct policy. You can't remember doing anything that might violate it. The note reads, I received a report that others are worried about your well-being. I'd like to meet with you to discuss your options for support and see what I can do to help. Engaging in any discussion of suicidal or self-destructive thoughts or actions with other students interferes with or can hinder their pursuit of education and community. It is important that you refrain from discussing these issues with other students and use the appropriate resources listed below. If you involve other students in suicidal or self-destructive thoughts or actions, you will face disciplinary action. My hope is that knowing exactly what could result in discipline, you can avoid putting yourself in that position. You are confused. You didn't mention anything about suicidal or self-destructive thoughts or actions when you visited the counseling center, and you have no intention of hurting yourself. 1,000 thoughts rush through your head. How did the Associate Dean of Students find out about your visit to the center? Isn't therapy supposed to be confidential? Why is the dean sending you a warning and a threat? And can the dean really tell you what you can and can't say to your friends? This scenario is not fiction. In 2015, a student at Northern Michigan University, NMU, visited the campus counseling center to get help in the aftermath of being sexually assaulted the year before. She did not mention anything about self-harm or suicidal thoughts during her session, yet the email she received from NMU's Associate Dean of Students included the exact text I just read. And she was not alone. 25 to 30 NMU students per semester received a version of that letter, whether or not they had expressed thoughts about suicide or self-harm. It was NMU's policy that students could be disciplined and even expelled for revealing these kinds of thoughts to other students. Given that the misguided policy was both stigmatizing and likely to put suicidal students at increased risk, mental health professionals roundly criticized the policy. Nevertheless, in an interview with a local newspaper, the dean defended the practice, claiming that relying on your friends can be very disruptive to them. Let me say that again. Relying on your friends can be very disruptive to them. The dean seemed to believe that if students talked about their suffering, it would harm their friends. It is an illustration of the untruth of fragility, what doesn't kill you makes you weaker, trumping common sense and basic humanity. What could compel a university, and in particular its Associate Dean of Students, to be so callous? This kind of administrative overkill was what first got Greg thinking about the ways in which universities teach cognitive distortions. When he started studying CBT in 2008, he saw administrators acting in ways that encouraged students to embrace a distorted sense that they lacked resilience, acting as if students could not handle uncomfortable conversations with or relatively small slights from their fellow students. In order to fully grasp the success of the three great untruths on campus, it's essential to understand how a growing campus bureaucracy has been unintentionally encouraging these bad intellectual habits for years, and how they still do today. This is our fifth explanatory thread. The corporatization of college. When the Federal Office of Education began collecting data in 1869, there were only 63,000 students enrolled in higher education institutions throughout the United States. They represented just 1% of all 18 to 24-year-olds. Today, an estimated 20 million students are enrolled in American higher education, including roughly 40% of all 18 to 24-year-olds. In the 2015 to 2016 school year, the most recent year for which statistics are available, combined revenues at U.S. post-secondary institutions totaled about $548 billion. A country with that GDP, to give a sense of scale, would rank 21st between Argentina and Saudi Arabia. At the end of the 2015 fiscal year, the U.S. universities with the 120 largest endowments held a total of $547 billion. U.S. elite institutions draw substantial international enrollment, and 17 of the top 25 universities in the world are in the United States. The enormous expansion of scope, scale, and wealth demands professionalization, specialization, and a lot of support staff. In 1963, Clark Kerr, the president of the University of California system, called the resulting structure the multiversity. In a multiversity, different departments and power structures within a university pursue different goals in parallel. For example, research, education, fundraising, branding, and legal compliance. Kerr predicted that as faculty increasingly focused on their own departments, non-instructional employees would take over in leading the institution. As he anticipated, the number of administrators has climbed upward. At the same time, their responsibilities have crept outward. Some administrative growth is necessary and sensible, but when the rate of that expansion is several times higher than the rate of faculty hiring, there are significant downsides, most obviously the increase in the cost of a college degree. A less immediately obvious downside is that goals other than academic excellence begin to take priority as universities come to resemble large corporations, a trend often bemoaned as corporatization. Political scientist Benjamin Ginsberg, author of the 2011 book The Fall of the Faculty, The Rise of the All-Administrative University and Why It Matters, argues that over the decades, as the administration has grown, the faculty, who used to play a major role in university governance, have ceded much of that power to non-faculty administrators. He notes that once the class of administrative specialists was established and became more distinct from the professor class, it was virtually certain to expand. Administrators are more likely than professors to think that the way to solve a new campus problem is to create a new office to address the problem. Meanwhile, professors have generally been happy to be released from administrative duties, even as they complain about corporatization. The customer is always right. A hallmark of the campus protest that began in 2015 was irresolute and accommodating responses by university leadership. Few schools imposed any kind of penalty on students for shouting down speakers or disrupting classes, even though these actions usually violated their own codes of conduct. Like George Bridges at Evergreen, many university presidents accepted ultimatums from students and then tried to meet many of the demands, usually without a word of criticism of the students' tactics. Critics of this approach have pointed out that this is the way organizations respond when their governing ethos is one of customer service. Eric Adler, a classics professor at the University of Maryland, distilled the argument in a 2018 Washington Post article. The fundamental cause of campus intolerance, he suggests, isn't students' extreme leftism or any other political ideology, but a market-driven decision by universities made decades ago to treat students as consumers who pay up to $60,000 per year for courses, excellent cuisine, comfortable accommodations, and a lively campus life. On the subject of students preventing certain people from speaking on campus, he explains, "Even at public universities, 18-year-olds are purchasing what is essentially a luxury product. Is it any wonder they feel entitled to control the experience? Students, accustomed to authoring every facet of their college experience, now want their institutions to mirror their views. If the customers can determine the curriculum and select all their desired amenities, it stands to reason that they should also determine which speakers ought to be invited to campus and what opinions can be articulated in their midst. For today's students, one might say, speakers are amenities. The consumerization theory fits with the trend toward greater spending on lifestyle amenities, which schools use when they compete with other schools to attract top students. From 2003 to 2013, public research universities increased spending on student services by 22.3%, which was far more than the increases for research, 9.5%, or instruction, 9.4%. Many campuses have become less like scholarly monasteries and more like luxurious country clubs. The trend is exemplified by Louisiana State University's 536-foot-long Lazy River, paid for with $85 million in student fees. This slow-moving current gently pushes floating students through a winding pool in the shape of the school's initials, LSU. At the ribbon cutting for the Lazy River, LSU's president explained how his vision of education combines consumerism and safetyism. "Quite frankly, I don't want you to leave the campus ever. So whatever we need to do to keep you here, we'll keep you safe here. We're here to give you everything you need." How campus administrators model distorted thinking. The shift towards seeing students as consumers explains a lot, but it cannot explain what happened at Northern Michigan University, or what administrators are thinking when they restrict the speech of their customers. To comprehend those events, we need to understand other forces acting on administrators, including the fear of bad publicity and threats of litigation. Administrators are bombarded with directives from in-house counsel, outside risk management professionals, the school's public relations team, and the upper echelons of the administration, that they must limit the university's legal liability in everything from personal injury lawsuits to wrongful termination, and from intellectual property to wrongful death actions. This is one reason they are so keen to regulate what students do and say. In the first decade of the 21st century, FIRE was the only organization entirely focused on free speech, academic freedom, and due process on college campuses. The lack of public attention to free speech on campus during that decade is understandable, given that the speech at the center of the debate was often rather unsympathetic, like what one professor said on September 11, 2001, when he joked, "Anybody who can blow up the Pentagon has my vote." Eventually, he lost his job. From a First Amendment standpoint, however, the cases were clear-cut. The amendment's bedrock principle is that offensiveness alone is no justification for banning or restricting speech, especially on campus. For most of Greg's career, students were consistently the most tolerant and pro-free speech constituency on campus, even more so than the faculty. Around 2013, however, Greg began to notice a change. More students seemed to be in agreement with the administrators that they were unsafe, that many aspects of students' lives needed to be carefully regulated by adults, and that it was far better to overreact to potential risks and threats than to underreact. In this way, campus administrators, usually with the best of intentions, were modeling distorted thinking. Two categories of First Amendment cases on campus encourage this kind of thinking quite directly: overreaction and overregulation. Overreaction cases. We define overreaction cases exactly as the name suggests. They are disproportionate responses to perceived offenses. Almost all overreaction cases model the mental habit of catastrophizing and communicate that disaster would result without the intervention of the administration. Here are two examples. Bergen Community College, New Jersey, 2014. An art professor was placed on leave without pay and sent to psychological counseling for a social media post. The post showed a photograph of his young daughter wearing a t-shirt that depicted a dragon and the words, "I will take what is mine with fire and blood," which the school claimed was threatening. The professor explained that the shirt referenced the popular TV series Game of Thrones, but an administrator insisted that fire could refer to an AK-47. Oakton Community College, Illinois, 2015. A professor received a cease and desist letter from his college based on a one-sentence email he had sent to a few colleagues. His email noted that May Day is a time when workers across the world celebrate their struggle for union rights and remember the Haymarket riot in Chicago. The college alleged that the reference to the 1886 riot was threatening to the college president because she was one of the recipients of the email. Why? Because the rally resulted in 11 deaths and more than 70 people injured. Of course, many major American holidays commemorate events that were far more costly in terms of lives lost. But when a reference is made to Memorial Day, Veterans Day, or even the 4th of July, nobody assumes it is a threat. Overregulation cases. Overregulation is less about policing actual offenses than it is about preventing potential offense. It is like a continuation of overprotective helicopter parenting. Administrators tightly regulate students in order to keep them safe. Speech remains a common target of overregulation, even though there have been more than 70 lawsuits against speech codes since the dawn of politically correct speech codes in the late 1980s. Almost all the codes challenged in court have been revised, abandoned, or ruled unconstitutional. Here are two of the most absurd categories of speech regulation that keep popping up on American college campuses. Category 1. Vague and overbroad speech codes. The code that epitomized the vagueness and breadth of the first wave of modern PC speech codes, roughly the late 1980s to the mid-1990s, was the University of Connecticut's ban on inappropriately directed laughter. The school was sued. It dropped the code as part of a settlement in 1990, but the same code, verbatim, was in effect at Drexel University in Philadelphia 15 years later. That code was eventually repealed after being named one of FIRE's Speech Codes of the Month. Along similar lines, a speech code at Alabama's Jacksonville State University provided that no student shall offend anyone on university property, and the University of West Alabama's code prohibited harsh text messages or emails. These codes teach students to use an overbroad and entirely subjective standard for determining wrongdoing. They also exemplify the untruth of emotional reasoning. Always trust your feelings. If you feel offended, then a punishable offense must have occurred. Speech codes like these teach the untruth of fragility as well. They communicate that offensive speech or inappropriate laughter might be so damaging that administrators must step in to protect vulnerable and fragile students. And they empower college administrators to ensure that authority figures are always available to resolve verbal conflicts. Category 2. Free speech zones. Universities never seem to tire of creating free speech zones, which restrict certain kinds of speech and expression to tiny and often remote parts of campus. FSZs seem to have first appeared in the 1960s and 70s as honored places where students could always engage in free speech, like Speaker's Corner in London's Hyde Park. But in the 1990s, many campuses made them the only places students could engage in free speech on campus. Some FSZs were revised after coming under public scrutiny and criticism, such as McNeese State University in Louisiana, where student groups' use of FSZs were limited to once per semester. Some have been struck down by courts, such as the University of Cincinnati's FSZ, which covered 0.1% of campus and required speakers to register 10 business days in advance. And yet, schools continue to maintain them. If you look at a college student handbook today, you'll find policies affecting many other aspects of students' lives, including what they can post on social media, what they can say in the dormitories to one another, and what they can do off campus, including what organizations they can join. Overreaction and overregulation are usually the work of people within bureaucratic structures who have developed a mindset commonly known as CYA, cover your ass. They know they can be held responsible for any problem that arises on their watch, especially if they took no action to prevent it. So they often adopt a defensive stance. In their minds, overreacting is better than underreacting, overregulating is better than underregulating, and caution is better than courage. This attitude reinforces the safetyism mindset that many students learned in childhood. See something, say something. It certainly did not help that today's college students were raised in the fearful years after the attacks of September 11th, 2001. Ever since that awful day, the U.S. government has been telling us, if you see something, say something. Even adults are told to follow their most anxious feelings. We found one example on a video sign at a train station where New Jersey Transit urges its passengers to embrace the untruth of emotional reasoning. The sign shows a suspicious-looking character. Next to him are the words, "See something, say something. If it doesn't feel right, it probably isn't." But that can't really be true. In all likelihood, there are millions of moments each year when some American somewhere thinks that something doesn't feel right and worries about an attack. However, there are only a few terrorist attacks of any kind each year in the United States, so in almost every case, the feeling is wrong. Of course, passengers on New Jersey Transit should alert someone if they see an abandoned backpack or suitcase, but that doesn't mean that their feelings are probably right. Young people have come to believe that danger lurks everywhere, even in the classroom and even in private conversations. Everyone must be vigilant and report threats to the authorities. At New York University in 2016, for example, administrators placed signs in the restrooms urging everyone to take a "feel something, say something" approach to speech. The signs outline for members of the NYU community how to report one another anonymously if they experience bias, discrimination, or harassment, including by calling a bias response line. NYU is not an outlier. A 2017 report by FIRE found that of the 471 institutions cataloged in FIRE's Spotlight on Speech Codes database, 38.4%, that is 181, maintain some form of bias reporting system. Of course, there should be an easy way to report cases of true harassment and employment discrimination. Such actions are immoral and unlawful. But bias alone is not harassment or discrimination. The term is not defined on the NYU Bias Response website, but psychological experiments have consistently shown that to be human is to have biases. We are biased towards ourselves and our in-groups, toward attractive people, toward people who have done us favors, and even toward people who share our name or birthday. Presumably, the administrators running the bias response line are most interested in negative biases based on identity categories, such as race, gender, and sexual orientation. But given the high levels of concept creep on university campuses and the widespread idea that microaggressions are ubiquitous and dangerous, there are sure to be some students who have a very low threshold for detecting bias in others and attributing ambiguous statements to prejudice. It becomes more difficult to develop a sense of trust between professors and students in such an environment. The bias response line allows students to report a professor for something said or shown even before the lecture has ended. Many professors now say that they are teaching on tenterhooks or walking on eggshells, which means that fewer of them are willing to try anything provocative in the classroom or cover important but difficult course material. For example, writing about her experience teaching sexual assault law, Professor Jeannie Suk Gerson of Harvard Law School observed in The New Yorker that asking students to challenge each other in discussions of rape law has become so difficult that teachers are starting to give up on the subject. If the topic of sexual assault were to leave the law school classroom, it would be a tremendous loss, above all to victims of sexual assault. To show just one example of how bias response systems discourage risk-taking, University of Northern Colorado adjunct professor Mike Jensen was called to multiple meetings after a single student filed a bias incident report following a discussion of controversial topics in a first-year writing class. The first reading assigned in the class was our Atlantic article, The Coddling of the American Mind. The professor asked the class to read the article and then engage in a discussion of a controversial topic to be chosen by the class. The topic that the students chose was transgender issues. One of the biggest stories that semester had been the revelation of Caitlyn Jenner's identity as a trans woman. Jensen suggested that students read an article about parents objecting to a transgender high school student using the girls' locker room. He explained that although most of the students might not agree with these skeptical views, in academia, grappling with difficult and controversial perspectives is expected, so it was important that even these viewpoints be discussed. Jensen later recalled the conversation as a very nice discussion of seeing other perspectives. He was surprised when he learned that a student had filed a bias incident report against him. He was advised to avoid the topic of transgender issues for the rest of the semester and was ultimately not rehired. The bureaucratic innovation of bias response tools may be well-intended, but they can have the unintended negative effect of creating an us-versus-them campus climate that results in hypervigilance and reduced trust. Some professors end up concluding that it isn't worth the risk of having to appear before a bureaucratic panel, so it's better to just eliminate any material from the syllabus or lecture that could lead to a complaint. Then, as more and more professors shy away from potentially provocative materials and discussion topics, their students miss out on opportunities to develop intellectual anti-fragility. As a result, they may come to find even more material offensive and require even more protection. Harassment and concept creep. Universities have an important moral and legal duty to prevent harassment on campus. What counts as harassment, however, has changed quite a lot in recent years. Modern conceptions of discriminatory harassment have their origins in Title VI and VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Title IX of the Education Amendments of 1972 expanded these statutes, prohibiting colleges that receive federal funds from discriminating against women with respect to educational opportunity. This protection was overdue and includes discrimination via harassment. Under these statutes, the bar for what counts as harassment is high, a pattern of severe behavior that effectively denies access to an educational opportunity or benefit. The pattern of behavior must also be discriminatory, that is, directed at someone who belongs to a protected class named in the statute, such as gender, race, or religion. In practice, however, the bar has been lowered. Many universities use the concept of harassment to justify punishing one-time utterances that could be construed as offensive, but don't really look anything like harassment. And some don't have anything to do with race or gender. For example, in 2005, at the University of Central Florida, a student was charged with harassment through personal abuse for creating a Facebook group that called the student government candidate a jerk and a fool. Perhaps you find that wrong or offensive, but should administrators be standing by, ready to step in whenever anyone feels offended? Or consider the case in which a student who worked as a janitor at his college was sanctioned because he was seen reading a book called Notre Dame versus the Klan, How the Fighting Irish Defeated the Ku Klux Klan, a book that celebrates the defeat of the Klan when they marched on Notre Dame in the 1920s. The image on the cover was upsetting to the two people who reported him. Lowering the bar that far trivializes the real harm that true harassment can do, and frequently does, to students' education. The purpose of these laws is to protect students from unlawful acts, not to empower censors. Nonetheless, in the 1980s, colleges defended the earliest codes as anti-harassment codes. Courts had no trouble seeing through this kind of explanation and routinely struck down the codes of this era, beginning in 1989 with the University of Michigan's speech code, which prohibited creating a demeaning environment through speech that stigmatizes or victimizes an individual. Yet even after numerous court defeats, universities claimed that the Department of Education required speech codes in order to comply with Title IX and other civil rights laws. In 2013, the Departments of Education and Justice issued a sweeping new definition of harassment. Any unwelcome conduct of a sexual nature, including verbal, nonverbal, or physical conduct. This definition was not limited to speech that would be offensive to a reasonable person, nor did it require that the alleged target actually be offended, both requirements of traditional harassment claims. By eliminating the reasonable person standard, harassment was left to be defined by the self-reported subjective experience of every member of the university community. It was, in effect, emotional reasoning turned into a federal regulation. The best example of how Title IX's expanded notions of harassment have come to threaten free speech and academic freedom comes from the case of Northwestern University professor Laura Kipnis. In a May 2015 Chronicle of Higher Education essay, Kipnis criticized what she saw as sexual paranoia on her campus, arising from changing attitudes towards sex and new ideas in feminism that she found disempowering. She wrote, "The feminism I identified with as a student stressed independence and resilience. In the intervening years, the climate of sanctimony about student vulnerability has grown too thick to penetrate. No one dares question it, lest you're labeled anti-feminist." Kipnis's essay criticized Northwestern's sexual misconduct policies, in particular the prohibition on romantic relationships between adult students and faculty or staff. She also mentioned a graduate student's Title IX complaint against a professor. After her article was published, Kipnis was the target of protests from student activists who carried mattresses across campus and demanded that the administration condemn the article. Then two graduate students filed a Title IX complaint against Kipnis, claiming that her article created a hostile environment. This resulted in a secret Title IX investigation of Kipnis that lasted 72 days. It ended after she published another article in the Chronicle titled "My Title IX Inquisition." When she wrote a book about her experience, she was subjected to yet another Title IX investigation, this time stemming from complaints by four Northwestern faculty members and six graduate students who claimed that her book's discussion of both Title IX and false sexual misconduct accusations violated the university's policies on retaliation and sexual harassment. This second investigation lasted a month. She was asked to respond to more than 80 written questions about her book and to turn over her source material. While both of these investigations were eventually dropped, from beginning to end, the process took more than 2 years. Kipnis noted after her ordeal, "My sense was that all of these protections were not making people less vulnerable, they were making people more vulnerable. Students are going to be impeded when they leave university and go out into the world, and nobody is going to protect them from the multitude of injuries and slights and that kind of thing that we all have to deal with in the course of daily life." How to foster moral dependency. In a prescient essay in 2014, two sociologists, Bradley Campbell and Jason Manning, explained where this new culture of vulnerability came from and how administrative actions helped it to grow. They called it victimhood culture, and they interpreted it as a new moral order that was in conflict with the older dignity culture, which is still dominant in most parts of the United States and other Western democracies. In an optimally functioning dignity culture, people are assumed to have dignity and worth regardless of what others think of them, so they are not expected to react too strongly to minor slights. Of course, full dignity was at one time accorded only to adult white men. The rights revolutions of the 20th and 21st centuries did essential work to expand dignity to all. This is in contrast to the older honor cultures, in which men were so obsessed with guarding their reputations that they were expected to react violently to minor insults made against them or those close to them, perhaps with a challenge to a duel. In a dignity culture, however, dueling seems ridiculous. People are expected to have enough self-control to shrug off irritations, slights, and minor conflicts, as they pursue their own projects. For larger conflicts or violations of one's rights, there are reliable legal or administrative remedies, but it would be undignified to call for such help for small matters, which one should be able to resolve on one's own. Perspective is a key element of a dignity culture. People don't view disagreements, unintentional slights, or even direct insults as threats to their dignity that must always be met with a response. For example, one clear sign of a dignity culture is that children learn some version of "sticks and stones will break my bones, but words will never harm me." That childhood saying is, of course, not literally true. People feel real pain as a result of words. If no one felt hurt by words, the saying would never be needed. But sticks and stones is a shield that children in a dignity culture use to dismiss an insult with contemptuous indifference, as if to say, "Go ahead and insult me. You cannot upset me. I really don't care what you think." In 2013, Campbell and Manning began noticing the same changes on campus that Greg had been noticing. The interlocking set of new ideas about microaggressions, trigger warnings, and safe spaces. They noted that the emerging morality of victimhood culture was radically different from dignity culture. They defined a victimhood culture as having three distinct attributes. First, individuals and groups display high sensitivity to slight. Second, they have a tendency to handle conflicts through complaints to third parties. And third, they seek to cultivate an image of being victims who deserve assistance. Of special relevance to our concerns in this chapter is the second attribute. Campbell and Manning pointed out that the presence of administrators or legal authorities who can be persuaded to take one side and intervene is a prerequisite for the emergence of victimhood culture. They noted that when administrative remedies are easily available and there is no shame in calling on them, it can lead to a condition known as moral dependence. People come to rely on external authorities to resolve their problems, and over time, their willingness or ability to use other forms of conflict management may atrophy. This is the concern that Kipnis voiced when she said that overprotective policies make students more vulnerable instead of less, and that schools are creating a culture of vulnerability. This is the concern that Erica Christakis expressed when she wrote that the growing tendency to cultivate vulnerability in students carries unacknowledged costs, and asked students to talk to each other rather than relying on administrative interventions. And it's the same concern about overprotection that prompted Lenore Skenazy to start the Free Range Kids movement. It is also the concern that Stephen Horwitz raised, and we discussed at the end of Chapter 9, about over-supervision impeding the development of the art of association. A university that encourages moral dependence is a university that is likely to experience chronic conflict, which may then lead to more moral dependence. In sum, 1. The growth of campus bureaucracy and the expansion of its protective mission is our fifth explanatory thread. 2. Administrators generally have good intentions. They are trying to protect the university and its students. But good intentions can sometimes lead to policies that are bad for students. At Northern Michigan University, a policy that we assume was designed to protect the university from liability led to inhumane treatment of students seeking therapy. 3. In response to a variety of factors, including federal mandates and the risk of lawsuits, the number of campus administrators has grown more rapidly than the number of professors, and professors have gradually come to play a smaller role in the administration of universities. The result has been a trend toward corporatization. 4. At the same time, market pressures, along with an increasingly consumerist mentality about higher education, have encouraged universities to compete on the basis of the amenities they offer, leading them to think of students as customers whom they must please. 5. Campus administrators must juggle many responsibilities and protect the university from many kinds of liabilities, so they tend to adopt a better safe than sorry, or CYA, approach to issuing new regulations. The proliferation of regulations over time conveys a sense of imminent danger, even when there is little or no real threat. In this way, administrators model multiple cognitive distortions, promote the untruth of fragility, and contribute to the culture of safetyism. 6. Some of the regulations promulgated by administrators restrict freedom of speech, often with highly subjective definitions of key concepts. These rules contribute to an attitude on campus that chills speech, in part by suggesting that freedom of speech can or should be restricted because of some students' emotional discomfort. This teaches catastrophizing and mind-reading, among other cognitive distortions, and promotes the untruth of emotional reasoning. 7. One recent administrative innovation is the creation of bias response lines and bias response teams, which make it easy for members of a campus community to report one another anonymously for bias. This feel-something-say-something approach is likely to erode trust within a community. It may also make professors less willing to try innovative or provocative teaching methods. They, too, may develop a CYA approach. 8. More generally, efforts to protect students by creating bureaucratic means of resolving problems and conflicts can have the unintended consequence of fostering moral dependence, which may reduce students' ability to resolve conflicts independently, both during and after college. Chapter 11, The Quest for Justice. A quotation from John Rawls from A Theory of Justice. Justice is the first virtue of social institutions, as truth is of systems of thought. Here's a quirk about American politics. The majority of white Americans vote for Republicans for president, unless they were born after 1981 or between 1950 and 1954. Why those who were born after 1981 vote differently is easy to understand. They are millennials or iGen. They lean left on most social issues and many economic ones, as Bernie Sanders discovered. They are less religious than previous generations, and the Republican Party turns them off in a variety of ways. But what's the story for those born from 1950 to 1954? They strongly favored Democrats through the 1980s and have been roughly evenly divided since then, with a slight lean overall toward the Democrats. You can see this for yourself and play with one of the best interactive political infographics ever by searching the internet for How Birth Year Influences Political Views. Why is there a little demographic island of Democrats among white Americans born in the early 1950s? Why do they vote differently in the 21st century than their siblings who were born a few years before or after them in the middle of the 20th century? The answer might be 1968. Or, rather, the period of emotionally intense national political events of 1968 and the years around it, roughly 1965 to 1972. The political scientists Yair Gitza and Andrew Gelman examined voting patterns of Americans to see whether political events or the political climate in childhood left some kind of mark on people's later political orientation. They found that there is a window of higher impressionability running from about age 14 to 24, with its peak right around age 18. Political events, or perhaps the overall zeitgeist as people perceive it, are more likely to stick during that period than outside that age range. For Americans born in the early 1950s, all you have to do to evoke visceral flashbacks to 1968 is say things like MLK, RFK, Black Panthers, Tet Offensive, My Lai, Chicago Democratic National Convention, Richard Nixon. If those words don't flood you with feelings, then do an internet search for Chuck Braverman 1968. The 5-minute video montage will leave you speechless. Just imagine what it must have been like to be a young adult developing a political identity, perhaps newly arrived on a college campus, as momentous moral struggles, tragedies, and victories happened all around you. We are in another such era today. And if Gitze and Gelman are correct, then the events and the political climate of the last few years may influence the way today's college students vote for the rest of their lives. Suppose you were born in 1995, the first year of iGen. You entered your politically most impressionable period when you turned 14 in 2009, just as Barack Obama was being sworn in. You got your first iPhone a year or two later, as smartphones became common among teenagers. If you went to college, you probably arrived on campus in 2013, the year you turned 18. What were the political events that you and your new friends were talking about, posting about, and protesting about? What were the issues on which you had to stake out your position with your tweets, posts, and likes? The government shutdown of October 2013? The long rise of the stock market? Not likely. The interests and activism of teens have far more to do with social issues and injustices than with purely economic or political concerns, and the 2010s have been extraordinarily rich in such issues. The list I'm about to read to you gives a small sampling of the major news stories related to what is commonly known as social justice in each year since the first members of iGen turned 14. In 2009 and 2010, some of the largest news stories in the United States were the ongoing financial crisis, healthcare reform, and the rise of the Tea Party. You can see that high-profile social justice stories become more numerous in subsequent years, just as the first members of iGen were preparing to go off to college. 2009, inauguration of Barack Obama. 2010, Tyler Clementi's suicide raises awareness of bullying of LGBT youth. 2011, Occupy Wall Street raises awareness of income inequality. 2012, killing of Trayvon Martin, re-election of Barack Obama, Sandy Hook Elementary School massacre raises interest in gun control. 2013, George Zimmerman acquitted of murder in the death of Trayvon Martin. Black Lives Matter founded. 2014, police killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. Police killing of Eric Garner in New York City with video. Black Lives Matter protests spread across America. Lead in drinking water in Flint, Michigan raises awareness of environmental justice. 2015, Supreme Court legalizes gay marriage. Caitlyn Jenner publicly identifies as a woman. White supremacist Dylann Roof massacres 9 black worshipers in Charleston, South Carolina. Confederate flags removed from state capitol in South Carolina. Police killing of Walter Scott with video. Universities erupt in protest over racism, beginning at Missouri and Yale, then spreading to dozens of others. 2016, terrorist Omar Mateen kills 49 in attack on gay nightclub in Orlando, Florida. Police killing of Alton Sterling with video. Police killing of Philando Castile with video. Killing of 5 police officers in Dallas. Quarterback Colin Kaepernick refuses to stand for national anthem. North Carolina requires transgender people to use bathrooms corresponding to the sex on their birth certificates. Protest against Dakota Access Pipeline at Standing Rock Indian Reservation. Nomination and election of Donald Trump. 2017. Trump inauguration. Trump attempts to enact various Muslim bans. Women's March in Washington. Violent protests against campus speakers at UC Berkeley and Middlebury. Trump bans transgender people from military service. Trump praises very fine people in Charlottesville March, during which a neo-Nazi kills Heather Heyer and injures others by driving a car into a crowd. 58 killed in largest mass shooting in U.S. history in Las Vegas. Start of the Me Too movement to expose and stop sexual harassment and assault. 2018, through March when this book went to press. Nicholas Cruz, expelled student with history of emotional and behavioral disorders, kills 17 at high school in Parkland, Florida. Students organize school walkouts and marches for gun control across the USA. Important, terrifying, thrilling, and shocking events happen every year, but the years from 2012 through 2018 seem like the closest we've come to the intensity of the stretch from 1968 to 1972. And if you're not convinced that the last few years are extraordinary by objective measures, then just add in the amplifying power of social media, Not since the Vietnam War and the civil rights struggles of the 1960s have so many Americans been exposed to a seemingly endless stream of videos showing innocent people, mostly people of color, being beaten, killed, or deported by armed representatives of the state. Today's college students have lived through extraordinary times, and as a result,